This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And you know, you research your investments, right? You analyze markets. You manage risk. But have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers' individual clients averaged an annual return of 24.3% compared to 23.1% on the S&P 500. IBKR's lower trading costs, competitive rates, efficient execution, and access to over 170 global markets help investors keep more of what they earn and put more capital to work. Over time, the broker you choose matters. Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. If you care about performance, find out why the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers at ibkr.com/performance. Again, that's ibkr.com/performance.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The high cost of investing, how to keep more of what you make. The tech trade is in tatters. Earnings are rolling in, and our guest today is Tom McClelland, from McClelland Market Report. All this and much more on episode number 982 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. We're on episode number 982, all the way running up to our anniversary that's coming up next year. It's going to be 20 years of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And thank you for listening. Thank you for being there. Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey that we've been having together. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of this podcast, also co-host of the Disciplined Investor, or actually, scratch that, DH Unplugged. I don't know where my head's at. DH Unplugged is the other podcast I do each and every week with John C. Dvorak. So I think that's something that you'll hopefully listen to because we have a lot of fun with that. We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to come up with new ideas and information about how to understand about what is really going on with the news on a regular basis. But today I want to talk about something before we get to our guest. I wanted to talk about the topic that probably doesn't get enough attention that it really deserves. The fact is, it's not really interesting because in today's world, what are we talking about? We're talking about AI. We're talking about technology. We're talking about interest rates. We're talking about the Fed and tariffs, recessions, all sorts of things. But we don't talk about this topic enough because we have market crashes and market bubbles, the next big thing. The fact is that these are really important, right? Every one of those topics are really important, and we have to focus in because it deals with what is happening on a regular basis with our money. But in fact, this other topic, this idea that we really need to flush out for a second here, probably could have a bigger impact on your investments than any of these things. And you're not going to hear about this at cocktail parties. You're not going to hear about this even from most of your advisors that you spend time with, because I'm talking about performance and asset allocation. And probably we don't spend enough time talking about with our clients or on the episodes here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We spend an inordinate amount of time talking about it in the office. And what is that? It's fees. It's not exciting. It's not sexy. Incredibly important that we talk about this because in the end, as we do mention from time to time, it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. So I'd argue, in fact, that fees are probably one of the most overlooked discussions and decisions that are made in the entire wealth creation process. We talk about market volatility. We talk about the inflation effects on your investments, right? That's always a discussion that happens. We talk about geopolitical uncertainty and where we can go and how to slant and twist and trim and rebalance and all these great things on a regular basis. What's the next hot thing? What's really going to be not? But in fact, most of those things we can't control. But if you think about it for a second, the one thing in this entire discussion that we can control, aside from, of course, where we put things, but the impact of how those things act on our portfolio, we can't. Fees. We can actually do something about that. Now think about what's happening here. Because again, we have no control of what the Fed does, and even if they do something, what the impact is going to be on our portfolio. We can't control earnings. We can't control economic reports and things that come out. The problem is that many of us don't even know what we're paying. So how can we have control of something that we really don't even understand? And I think even far fewer of us have a long-term understanding of the consequences of what they do to a portfolio. Now, one of the reasons fees are so easy to ignore is that the fact is that they're hard to see, they're hard to find, they're hard to even understand because they're pretty much invisible. They come out of your mutual fund directly, your ETF, or even your account. You don't receive a monthly bill from many of these places. I mean, we send monthly invoices and quarterly invoices to our clients, of course, but that doesn't include things like mutual fund fees and ETF fees. And if you're in any kind of private equity, et cetera, it's usually just the net number that we're thinking about. And the charge appearing on like your credit card statement or something, it doesn't appear. And you don't get a reminder saying, hey, congratulations, thank you so much for paying that nice quarterly fee to your mutual fund. Instead, you're basically paying fees quietly. It's under the radar and kind of out of your view. And that's something that is okay as long as you know that you've got the best fees possible for what you're doing. We spend an incredible amount of time behind the scenes on behalf of you, of our clients. What do? We're worrying about fees. Because you know what? The truth of the matter is fees impact our revenue as well. The performance on our portfolios are only as good as what our net returns are, minus the fees that are being charged from any places. And we make more money as our clients make more money, right? That makes sense. So if these fees are high and they're really cutting into the overall performance and net value of a portfolio, we make less. Why would we want to do that? That makes no sense. So while we are working on this behind the scenes, I think it's important for you to stop for a second and think about what are my fees, right? If you ever are in 401ks and or with an advisor or investing on your own, we're not talking about individual equities. We're really talking about packaged products like ETFs and mutual funds. And when you have lower fees, the ability to compound your investments more because earnings generate more earnings, growth becomes self-reinforcing. And that's one of the most powerful things, right? The compounding effect. Einstein called it what? The eighth wonder of the world, 10th wonder of the world, whatever it is. Compounding is magic, how we have the opportunity to increase our wealth by this increase of growth on a regular basis. And it's not just the fee itself that matters on its own either. It's the loss and all the future earnings that you have, the potential on compounding on an annual basis that is lost because of fees that you really shouldn't have been paying. And I think what surprises investors the most all the time is how large this impact can be, because a difference in 1 percentage point a year or 1.5 percentage point or even a small amount, it can be significant over a period of time like 10, 20, 30 years. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially on a portfolio. And instead of those dollars being transferred elsewhere, often without you, the investor, being knowing about this and realizing this, I propose that we keep it in your pocket. I propose that you find a way to pay the least possible. You got to pay something, right? It's a service. It's what you do. How do we find a way? And that's what we get paid for. We get paid to actually find two things. Well, three things, I would say. a portfolio model that meets the particular risk factors and time horizon that meets your criteria and can get the greatest bang for the buck in terms of performance with the investments that we have that are situated in a specific area, a sector, or not, or out of it. That's number one. The second thing is to make sure that you are investing correctly, right, on a tax-efficient way, but also that you're paying the least fees possible to do so. Do we want, for example, a mutual fund for an asset class that's efficient, that we are just replicating an index? Why would we pay 0.75%, 1% to a mutual fund when we could pay 0.1%, like 90% less, to an ETF that's more tax efficient in that area and has a much lower fee, and in the end probably has to take less risk to get to the same place because they don't have to make up their fees? And this is where I think we frequently encounter issues when we're starting to initially look at portfolios for prospective clients, right? You send us in your portfolio, we look at it, we're like, you know, these are good funds, but oh my, you're paying on average 0.8% more with this mutual fund stack that you have than you should. Why hasn't your advisor come out and said, you know what, we need to do something about this? Because in some cases, it was a perfectly, I would say, reasonable choice of funds considering the landscape of the investing world right now. But today, often low-cost alternatives are there. And one of the things that a lot of players don't do, and what we strive to do, is find on what's called a hub-and-spoke model the cheapest alternative. So, for example, mutual fund A has a share class called retail. They have an A, B, C class, et cetera. There's also institutional classes that are out there. We have the ability to get institutional classes for our clients that can cost you maybe, I don't know, 30% of what the retail class actually pays. And far too often what we find is that funds are charging way too much. And this is exactly what we do. And that's why I encourage people to think about why. What's the reason? Why am I going to use an advisor? Well, we could find these cost-saving factors for you. And sure, you're going to pay us some to do that. But bottom line, in the end, our fees should not come in the way of what's happening. And if you haven't done this exercise before, whether you're using an advisor or not, I want you to spend a little bit of time doing this. I want you to go and look at your mutual funds, your ETFs, your portfolio entirely, and find out, what am I actually paying? So if you're using an advisor, and you're using mutual funds, and you're using ETFs, look at that. Like I said, we spend an inordinate amount of time, ridiculous amount of time, going through where we can find the least expensive way to make sure to get the same exposure for a particular sector for a client. And if we have one versus the other, we're going to pick the cheaper one if all else things make sense. Now, we'll use ETFs for efficient markets. We'll use mutual funds for inefficient markets. But this distinction that I'm talking about is so important for you, because not every part of the portfolio should be treated the same way. Again, maybe fixed income, where we don't have as much efficiency, we want to be in some fixed mutual funds, right? Actively trading. And the rise of ETFs, from what I've seen, adds to this conversation and in effect has totally changed the conversation over the last number of years. And that's an incredible advantage for investors. And if you haven't embraced the idea of using ETFs in your portfolio, I think it's time to start considering that. That's just a little point of really what I want to talk about today in terms of making sure that you have, again, the most efficient way of getting to that level of financial security in the future. One of the things we're talking about is very simple. It's just making sure that you're doing what you can to reduce fees. And if you can't do so on your own, because a lot of times these institutional funds that I talk about are only available at $1 million minimum or more, some 2 million. Well, how are you going to do that if you have a $500,000 portfolio in total? That's where we come in a lot of times, where we have that for clients. We can take all of our clients and put them into one conceptual amount that we say to the fund family, hey, you know what? We got enough. We got $5 million in that fund. We got $10 million. We want clients that even have 50,000 are coming that we want to allocate to that particular fund to be able to use that fund. And we can. So it doesn't have to be very difficult. It doesn't have to be something that you struggle with. If you can't do it, you know what? Go to the website. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew. Click on the Contact Us. You want us to take a look at your portfolio, put it on the racks, figure out what you're paying, if you're paying too much or what's going on. Find out some alternatives and see if it's worthwhile to think about doing anything at all. But something I wanted to bring up to you because it was really, I've been thinking about this for a while, the whole idea of fees, just this invisible abrasive that impacts your portfolio dramatically. We're going to get to our guest. But before we do that, I want to talk about interactive brokers. You know, there's something important to talk about when you think about your portfolio, because you trade your portfolio, but now you can trade your portfolio with the power of prediction market probabilities. With interactive brokers, trade prediction markets on election, climate, and economic outcomes right alongside stocks, options, and bonds. Pretty cool. Prediction market prices reflect probability and correct predictions, receive $1 per contract, plus earn interest on your position. Prediction contracts are not suitable for all investors. Visit ibkr.com/predictions. So let's get right to our guest. It's Tom McClellan this week. He's been around many, many years with the show. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where he studied aerospace engineering, served as an Army helicopter pilot for 11 years. And then he began studying his own way of doing market technical analysis while he's actually still in the Army, and he discovered ways to expand the use of his parent indicators to forecast future market turning points. In 95, they all launched the newsletter, the Market McClellan Market Report, an 8-page or 9-page, or I guess usually 8, that reports on stock, bonds, and gold markets, all sorts of other intermarket relationships, et cetera. Daily Edition was added in 1998, so lots of really great things. Let's get right to Tom. So Tom, welcome back to The Disciplined Investor.
Great to see you, Andrew.
Thanks. Yeah, great to see you. This is the first time we're actually doing this where we could see each other.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome.
You look good.
Yeah, so do you. So do you. I understand you have a new puppy.
Yeah, in a new puppy named Molly. Labrador Retriever.
Uh-huh.
Our 13-year-old dog is not excited about this prospect.
I'm sure.
The puppy getting up in her face is really not her favorite thing.
Yeah. So I want to get right into some stuff. You know, you have an incredible amount of detailed information related to the markets, an incredible amount of history that you look at all the time. And you do a lot of analogs. You do a lot of things that a lot of people don't do, that some things absolute, where you look at it and it's just, you can see the information, like what's the advanced decline line, things like that. Some things you do are like solar flares and things of that nature. But I want to talk about the Fosbach absolute breadth, which you've recently highlighted this, right? You've talked about the absolute breadth indicator, which suggests that markets have gotten kind of quiet from a historical standpoint. What is that? First of all, what does it mean? How does it work? How do you get there? And what are we to take from this?
Well, to start with, what technical analysts mean when we talk about the daily breadth, that's how many advancing issues versus how many declining issues.
Okay.
So the difference between those is the daily breadth. And if you sum that over a long period of time, on a cumulative basis, add every day's value to the prior total, you get the advanced decline line. Most of the time, the advanced decline line does exactly what prices do, but sometimes they diverge, and that's really important information. Fosbach, Norman Fosbach, many years ago, and I believe he's still alive, analyst active back in the 70s and 80s, he came up with an idea to ignore the direction of whether it's positive breadth or negative breadth, and just look at the size of it. How big was the number? So that's why you're talking about absolute numbers. If you go back to calculus and engineering classes, absolute numbers take off the plus or the minus sign. We're just looking at how big it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally all over the place most of the time. But sometimes it gets really loud and big numbers. Sometimes it gets really quiet. And those tend to correlate with what prices are doing. At bottoms, you get really, really loud breadth numbers. And at tops, you get really, really quiet ones, because at tops, everybody's feeling great. The market's in an uptrend. We're complacent. The VIX is low. Life is good. I'm a genius. I'm going to make money forever. And so people don't care. And they get really quiet with their activity. And the volume in ETFs goes down. The volatility goes down. And the volatility in the breadth numbers goes down. And so when you see on a smooth basis, and I like to use a 21-day moving average, when you see the FOSBAC absolute breadth number get down to a quiet level, it is a topping indication. Now, a topping indication is not the same thing as a topping signal. It's not the moment of the top. It's just saying you are in a topping condition now. A top could happen at any time, or it could not happen for a while. That's the thing about conditions. It's not the same thing as a signal. So hopefully everybody understands what we're talking about there.
Right. So it's interesting because this could be a sign of complacency. Right at this point, that's a possibility.
Well, for sure it is, yeah. But, it's definitely a sign of complacency, but whether that complacency is going to matter,
right,
that's a different question.
That's the point I was going to make there, that sometimes you look at things like, analogs to different time periods, and you look at this period, moved up and down, but it may not, when we think that, well, this should be a signal that something's going to move down and look at the historical levels of this and how it did, it may only be a slight move down, for example. Right. It doesn't have to be that full length, but that qualifies it. Well, it happened again, that it moved down. In this circumstance, you're mentioning it sign of complacency, and it's a sign of quiet period where people are just, but that doesn't mean it, number one, has to roll over. Number two, it doesn't mean it has to roll over if it does now. And the third thing is it doesn't have to be a huge rollover if it does roll over, right?
That's right. You can get the direction right, but the magnitude can do lots of different things, and that's true about a lot of different indicators. That they'll tell you the direction. They won't tell you what the magnitude's going to be because the magnitude may not yet be decided. If we have another war with somebody else besides Iran, that will affect the magnitude. If China decides to invade Taiwan, that will affect the magnitude. If everybody gets real quiet and the Fed keeps doing QE5, that will affect the magnitude in a quieting way.
Right.
And so there are lots of things that haven't happened yet that can definitely have an impact on magnitude, which is why if you're going to forecast magnitude or direction, pick one, but don't try to pick both.
Right.
Getting the timing and the direction and the magnitude right is a really hard thing to do because the market doesn't reveal those secrets to us.
Right. It's only after the fact that we could say, I knew it.
But at the same time, our job is to get the direction right, irrespective of what the magnitude is going to be. Because if you get the direction right, the magnitude will take care of itself.
Yep.
You're never going to get more out of a move than the total size of the move. So don't start counting your chickens ahead of time on how big the move has to be to satisfy you. Get the move and the direction right and worry about other things another time.
So something you said that was kind of interesting that you and I probably find to be pretty basic, run-of-the-mill, you talked about using a 21-day moving average. And I want to make sure I'm clear about this because I think there's a lot of people that wonder what that means. And I know it's pretty basic for you and I. But it is not 21 days like as in 3 weeks, because 3 weeks include Saturdays and Sundays and maybe holidays, right?
Right. So calendar days and trading days are different. When technical analysts talk about a 50-day moving average or a 200-day moving average or a 21-day moving average, we're talking about trading days because that's what matters to us. 21 trading days happens to be about 1 month because most months have about 21 trading days in them. So you can use whatever moving average you like on any indicator, including the FOSBAC absolute breadth. I have just found that 21 days makes for a really nice indicator. You can tinker around and try other ones, and good luck to you. But that's just something that I found that works nicely.
You know, what's interesting, I don't think I've ever brought this up to you, but since we're talking about moving averages, it's bringing a little bit of a historical reference for me. There's a lot of moving averages, like, for example, the 50, the 100, the 150, and the 200-day moving average that analysts like to talk about, right? And what I have found of what's the relative, this is my opinion, and then I want you to comment on this, and then I want to talk about moving average fitting. But the 100, the 50, the 150, the 200, those are kind of the standard you hear about usually for markets. My belief is it's not that those have relevance or important. It's the relevance and important that we put on those as the totality of investors and why you'll see a bounce off that 50-day. The magic is not the 50-day line. The magic is that we make something of it. Does that make sense?
There's some truth to that. If everybody is watching the 200-day moving average and everybody knows about it and everybody sees the price approaching it and they're watching it happen, then yes, it can acquire some self-fulfilling importance. Generally speaking, though, what you want to do if you're picking out a moving average you want to tap into an inherent cycle that's happening in the market. And there are cycles of lots of different lengths. There are very sophisticated tools that you can use to find those cycles, but they're going to wander around a little bit and they're not going to be exactly perfect. The foundation for the study of cycles is a great organization that's just been stood back up by some really smart people. They have some great software which goes after finding out cycles in any set of data using Fourier analysis, which is super, super difficult mathematics that the computers can handle really well. But what you want to do once you find a cycle is you want to pick a moving average that is half the period of the cycle. Because mm-hmm. if you use the entire period, you'll smooth it out and it'll just be flat.
Right.
So you want half the period and your moving average. What that means, though, is that you can approach it a different way. You can tinker around lots of different different moving average periods mm-hmm. and lengths. And when you find one that you like, that's good, that works for you well, the reason it works well is probably that it's tapping into a cycle you don't even know about. And so that's a backward way of finding out and matching yourself to the cycle. Analysts have been using 50 and 200 because they're nice big round numbers for a long time.
Yeah.
They seem to work pretty well. But years ago when my parents, Sherman and Marion McClellan, first started doing their work in the 60s, they turned to exponential moving averages instead of simple moving averages.
Which I think I think those are much better, just from a logical standpoint, a much better to look at what's happening more recent than in the totality of that cycle or of that period.
Well, and they turned to it back then. I agree in a lot of cases. There's a use for both of them. Exponential moving averages are better from a mathematical standpoint, especially from the standpoint of in the 60s, because if you're going to do a 200-day moving average, you got to know every data point from now to 200 days back, and you got to keep track of that. And then that will only change. The 200-day moving average will only change based on the new data coming in and the 201st data that's falling out. All the rest of them stay the same.
Yep.
An exponential moving average only depends on the new data and how far you are away from the moving average. And so it's a lot easier to keep track of mathematically. In fact, the math was borrowed from rocketry, because when you're designing a guidance system for a rocket, you want to smooth the inputs so that you don't adjust the tail fins on the rocket to steer toward the target too quickly. You want to smooth it. And so they used exponential moving averages for that. Which was easier to code into analog circuits because you only had to keep track of two things, whereas with a simple moving average or other math, you had a lot more math to keep track of, and it was harder to code that way. So a guy named Pete Harlan was a big influence on my parents back in the 60s. He was an actual rocket scientist at the Jet Propulsion Lab, and he was the first guy west of the Mississippi anyway to use a computer for doing stock market analysis, because he had access to one, and he typed in data on IBM cards and ran it at night when he could get on the computer, and he used exponential moving averages.
That's
so
great.
There's definitely a place for that.
That's great. So I have a good friend, John Markman. He would do writings all the time. This is what kind of got me interested in all the differentials on how these are constructed. But he would have like, hey, let's look at this. But it was a fitted moving average. So he would tinker around with a moving average on a stock to see where that stock was finding, let's say, support on a regular basis more times than not. And it was a fitted. So you would have, I'm just picking this out of the blue, maybe. IBM would have a 93-day moving average or something like that. That would be the number that somehow, for some reason, that was the number for that stock, that whether it was just happenstance that it was what it was at this point, or whether some players were actually using that, but that always seemed to fit very nicely in his logic. Just a weird situation.
Well, and there's some utility to that. Going back to what we're talking about is you're basically hunting, by using a moving average, you're hunting for what the cycle is that's dominant in that data series.
Right.
And using a different moving average and trying different ones is one way to home in on that information. But cycles can change. And you, it's possible to overfit. You run into the risk of overfitting to the data and having the future data not necessarily work the same as right. the past data, yeah. even though you expected it. So it can cut both ways.
Yep. So you recently talked about oil, and you talked about oil's upturn was on time. But this kind of, by the way, talks about our cyclical nature and depths and timing issues, where something can be right, but it may the magnitude. So you talked about it was overdone by the Iran war. And you wrote that oil's rally was fundamentally on schedule. But now the question is, what does the normalization in oil prices tell us now?
And let me cover the background of how that forecast came about. Oil prices, in their movements, they tend to match the movements of gold prices about 20 months ago. So whatever gold was doing 20 months ago, that's what oil prices are going to be doing now. Not perfectly, not exactly. And as we discussed, the magnitude can be very different based on events. And so the upturn that we saw in oil when it bottomed down near 60 and went up to above 100 got overly magnified by the U.S. going to war with Iran and shutting down the Persian Gulf. And that obviously had a big impact on the magnitude of the movements. But the upturn was on schedule. So now you've got a situation where the price has gone way off track, and it's got to get itself back on track to be matching what gold's message says. If you remember gold 20 months ago, gold was about $2,500, and it jumped up to $5,300. That doesn't necessarily mean that oil has to double. Just because gold doubled, it doesn't mean that, but it does mean that it should be upward. Oil has oversteered a little bit, gone off the road, and it's got to oversteer the other way to get back on the road. But the road is still pointed higher based on what gold was doing 20 months ago. And so we've seen the premium, the war premium, coming back out of oil to get it back on track again. And it should start to resume what the normal uptrend was going to be before the war amplified the movement a little bit much.
So I know I'm hearing telepathically the questions from our listeners, and they probably asking this question because you do this a lot and looking at offset analogs, right? Why 20 months? Now, I know you're probably going to tell me because that's what works, but seriously, why 20 months?
I wish I had a better answer than that, but that is the best answer. That is what works. And it's been working for decades. It also works in bond yields with a slightly different offset. It's about 19.8 months for oil, and it's about 20 and a half months for bond yields, because that's just what fits the best. And it doesn't fit perfectly all the time. So this up move that we saw in gold 20 months ago, it is telling us about the up move that is underway in bond yields and should be getting back underway in oil prices. I wish I knew why it works. But this is not the same thing as an analog, where Paul Tudor Jones was famous in 1987 for noticing that the pattern of the stock market in 1987 looked a whole lot like the pattern of the stock market in 1929. And so that is a true analog, where prices are tracing out the same dance steps from one period to another. It's a leading indication relationship between gold and oil, or gold and interest rates, which is different than an analog.
Right.
What you're seeing in that leading indication relationship is you're basically seeing the same waves hit one market, and then those same waves hit another market. It's like if you're standing on the end of a pier out in the ocean and you watch a wave go underneath your feet, well, that same wave is going to hit the shore sometime later. And so you can think of gold as being out on the end of the pier and telling us that there's a wave coming, and bonds and crude oil are on the shore, that same wave is going to hit them after the lag time goes by. Why it's that much doesn't really matter, as long as we can figure out what the lag time is. It doesn't change what we do to know the purpose behind that lag time. It's just how the universe works. Yep. Our job is to figure out the universe's rules as opposed to telling the universe how it's supposed to work.
Do our best on that. So, first of all, I want to mention that Tom has some great stuff that he does that you can get. You can get a letter that he puts out on a regular basis. Tell everybody, before we get to the end of the show, I want to do it now. How does everybody get your letter, and where do they find stuff?
Well, mcoscillator.com is our website. You can see our samples of our twice-monthly stock market newsletter, the McClellan Market Report that I write with my father, Sherman, who's still alive. He turns 92 this month, and he's still working, still loving doing the work. And we also write a daily edition every day the market trades. If you're not sure you're ready to pony up the money for the good stuff, you can get some good free information in our weekly chart and focus series. It's just I pick a chart every week and talk about it in depth. And you can sign up for that for free. You can also see every issue of the Chart and Focus all the way back to 2009. So people ask, when are you going to write a book, Tom? And I say, well, I've been writing it one chapter a week since 2009. It's just in serial format.
Yep. So one of the things, the hallmark, which carries your name, I know that your parents put it together because you and I have talked. Listen, you and I have been talking since 2009 or 8 or something like that. We've been going back a long time, you and I. And by the way, just to let you know, 20 years of this podcast is coming up March of 2027. 20 years.
Wow, that's great.
Which makes me feel old, but that's another story entirely.
20 years ago, the word podcast was just brand new.
Brand new. I wrote my first book. My publisher said, you should do a podcast. And I said, what's the beep is a podcast? And actually I had the fortunate, fortunately what happened was I was invited to Apple in Cupertino to help me set this up. And back then it was using GarageBand. I just looked the other day because I wanted to get a good timestamp on the date. I believe it was March 7, 2000. And seven, that the first one was actually out. And I remember to this day how nervous I was with a microphone, this crappy microphone, with GarageBand sitting in front of me, with a stack of notes and almost script for my first show because I didn't know if I could actually talk. Now, you stick me in front of a microphone, you can't shut me up. So that's a whole different thing. McClellan Oscillator, the structure. Recently, you talked about how there was a complex structure. I know this because I've followed your work and I think I'm a relatively, I would say I'm an expert. I know a good amount of how you calculate. I've actually coded some stuff on my own systems utilizing what you've helped me with design. One of your recent reports talked about a complex, not simple, a complex McClellan oscillator structure. And it was below zero. So tell me what that means from the aspect of what a complex versus simple and what below zero means.
Well, it's tough to do charts on the radio or without, I didn't bring a chart to talk about it, but people can see a chart of the McClellan oscillator every day updated at our website at mcoscillator.com. The name of the website is just a contraction of McClellan oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed and became famous for. The McClellan oscillator measures the acceleration that's taking place in the advanced decline line. So if you have a positive McClellan oscillator reading, that means that it's accelerating upward at the moment. If it's negative, that means that it's accelerating downward at the moment. And people should understand that if you're in a downtrend and you level off, that's actually a positive acceleration because you're no longer going down. You're feeling the G-forces of the roller coaster hitting the bottom. That's a positive acceleration. So you can get positive acceleration showing up in the McClellan oscillator without yet getting price movement upward. The McClellan oscillator does interesting things when you look at the patterns. And this was what my parents wrote about in their 1970 book, Patterns for Profit. When you see the patterns in the oscillator that reveal things, and one of the most important of these patterns is what we call complex or simple structures. A simple structure is where the oscillator just goes straight up and straight down above zero, or it can be simple on underneath the zero. It just makes a spike. A complex one is where you have a crossing of zero and then it chops around before it goes back the other way. Complex structure tells you that side is the side that is in charge because it has the ability to do some chopping around before crossing back and going the other way. So when you see a complex structure below zero, the message is that the bears are in charge.
Okay.
Now they may lose being in charge. It may be third down and they fail to get a first down, and so they have to punt. That may happen. When you see a simple structure, that tells you that side is not in charge. Mm-hmm. It's possible to have alternating simple structures on both sides where neither side is in charge. And I think we're going to see a lot of that this summer. Something that you talked about, getting the magnitudes different. We have a very quirky situation in terms of liquidity in the market where the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line is making new highs, but it's doing it very, very quietly. So when the advanced decline line is making new highs, it is making a statement that liquidity is plentiful, but it's not gobs of plentiful. It's just barely plentiful. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing the same thing in other indicators like high yield bonds. Their advanced decline line is not making new highs. We're not seeing all the horses pulling together. So the NASDAQ is going down while the Dow is making new highs. And it's not a very altogether market. So I we're in the second year of a presidential term when you're supposed to see a bear market. Mm-hmm. That's the very normal time. 2022 was a great example. It was a bear market year. 2026 is 4 years later. We're in the second year. You're supposed to see a bear market. And I think we're going to have one, but not a voracious one. Just kind of a meandering, boring, we'll lose a little bit. So this is a great is a great summer to work on your novel and come back and be a buyer again in about mid-October.
I love it.
Because I don't think there's going to be a whole lot happening. And I'm sorry to come on your news show and say, well, there's not going to be much happening. Because that's really boring. You know, people tune into NASCAR to see the car crashes and the speeding cars. This is not going to be a car crashes and speeding cars kind of market. It's going to be a boring market where there's going to be opportunities for the nimble on a short-term basis. But most people are going to be frustrated between now and mid-October.
Well, there hasn't been anything that's really significantly boring about the market. There's a couple of days here and there. One of the things that's fascinating has been the rotation that they're not allowing the market to go down. Clearly algorithms that are taking control of things where they're pulling money out of some of the big names, throwing it into the small caps. Then they're rotating it back into the industrials and basically keeping everything semi-levitated for a period of time. One of the things that's interesting to look at with that is divergences. In particular, you talked about and recently wrote about the NASDAQ versus NVIDIA. And you pointed out that NVIDIA and the NASDAQ have started kind of like going in different directions, and particularly, I guess, the NASDAQ 100. So, but why is that important?
Well, it's important now because it's been important before. And this is a different way of looking at divergences. You're talking about a chart that I've showed where I compare the share price action in NVIDIA versus the NASDAQ 100. Most of the time, as you would expect, those two do exactly the same thing because NVIDIA is the number one largest component of the NASDAQ 100. Or should I call it the NASDAQ 101, since now they've added SpaceX, but they didn't take anything out. So we have 101 companies in the NASDAQ 100. So it's really the NASDAQ 101. When you see them doing the same thing together, that's the normal condition. What we've seen just recently is that NVIDIA stock peaked before the NASDAQ 100 index and it started going down. When we have seen that in the past, that's been a bad sign for the overall NASDAQ market. And then sure enough, NVIDIA was right, and the NASDAQ has turned sideways and is chopping its way a little bit lower. So that divergence that NVIDIA was showing has borne out, not in terms of bringing a crash or a horrific decline, but in terms of the uptrend stopping and turning weak. This is a different kind of divergence, though, because normally when we look at divergences in the advanced decline line or junk bonds or something, we're looking at the behavior of the strong versus the weak,
right?
Where if the weak start falling by the roadside, then eventually the liquidity drying up is going to affect the big stocks. This is backwards from that. This is looking at the biggest of the big stocks in NVIDIA, and it starts to act weak. So that's a different way of doing it, which bothers me a little bit to do it differently, but it works. And so that's why I pay attention to it and shared it with my readers.
So, you know, it's interesting because I you mentioned something in a moment ago. You mentioned two things. You mentioned it may be a down cycle and you mentioned choppiness. And I probably should have brought this up when we talked about Fosback and when we talked about the volatility and we talked about the advanced decline line. Mm-hmm. But you highlighted that the S&P 500 choppiness index has reached multi-decade lows. First of all, what exactly does that measure and what is that telling us?
Well, that was analysis from about a month ago, if I remember correctly, and it shared it in my Chart and Focus article.
I read it.
The choppiness index was created by an Australian commodities trader named E.W. Dries. And he wanted to, he was doing something similar to what Fosbach was doing with absolute breadth. He wanted an indicator that could depict how choppy or linear price movements have been recently, irrespective of which direction.
Right.
So if you have a very low choppiness index, that means that you have been in a very linear trend for the look back period. Mm-hmm. And he liked to use 14 trading days. And I find that works really well. A low choppiness index reading tells you you're due to end that trend because you've been trending for too long. Similarly, a high choppiness index reading means you are have been too choppy and trendless for long enough that a new trend direction ought to develop in one direction or the other. It won't tell you in which direction that new trend is going to go. Mm-hmm. You just need to look at your MACD or your price oscillators or whatever you look at to get indications of trend change and be ready for it. The high choppiness index reading is telling you get ready for a trend to break out in one direction or the other. What we were seeing a month ago was a super linear trend coming out of the March 30th low in the S&P 500. I mean, there was just no texture to that uptrend at all. It was a straight line, which resulted in the lowest choppiness index reading that it, in the data that I have going back about three decades. I mean, you can go back farther than that, but what's the point? It's saying, oh my gosh, this is super linear. And thus, we're due for a nonlinear period for prices. And that's kind of what we're going through now.
So after 40 years of analyzing markets, what do you, of all the things we've talked about, what is the most, in your opinion, the most reliable indicator that you currently follow that most of the other players on various financial networks and all that don't even have a desire to even look at or don't even know to look at? Is there one thing that's your go-to right now after all these years?
And you're going to ask me which of my children I love the most?
Yes. I'm giving you a Sophie's choice right now.
I'm gonna tell you something that I'm gonna answer the way my friend Steve Todd answered it. Steve Todd has been a stock market analyst for many years. Writes the Todd Market Forecast. Speaks with a deep Southern Alabama accent. He says there's a lot of indicators out there. They're all good ones, and I like them, and I like to use them. But when it comes down to it, I like to just look at a plain old bar chart, and I ask the chart, "Is you is or is you ain't in an uptrend?" And so looking at the price matters, because what price does is going to determine whether you make money on the trade. Indicators are just a representation of that. And I'm a big indicators guy, and I'm a big mathematical guy, but you really still have to bring it back to the bar chart and see what it's doing.
Yep. So, over time, there's, you know, all these different indicators and all these things that you look at, right? So is there something you have found that more recently that you could say are really things that I want to look at, and that's what I'm focusing on? The other things are not working. And let me just back this up by saying one other thing. For many years, on a particular channel that deals with financial news, the people on there, for some reason, got their hands around the RSI index, right? This RSI, Relative Strength Index. Yeah. That's a charting mechanism to show where it is compared to where it was and what it's been. Like, is this moving more than it's moved before? That particular index doesn't put it against anything else. Here's my question to you is, I don't know, why would they use something like that? You know, new traders always use MACD, moving average, convergence, divergence. They find that to be fascinating, right? That particular thing, because they get a signal. What's with the RSI? And is that something that is just because they're just used to it? They're just comfortable with it?
Well, RSI was created by Wells Wilder. Great indicator. You have to learn how to interpret it, though, because you can't just take the number and say, oh, it's a 70, therefore 70. I need to do this.
Right. That's the number, by the way. Tom just gave you the number that everybody looks like, over 70, under 70, whatever. That's
or
the
under
number.
30, yeah. You can't just look at the number and know what to do. You got to look at the chart, because whether it's making higher highs or making divergent lower highs, that matters. Whether it's making a divergent low, that matters. It can show overbought and oversold, but that doesn't mean that the market has to react to that right away. So it has information. It's a great indicator, but it's not everything all at once. And so TV people like to fall in love with the perfect indicator. They like to say, oh, I'm just going to look at one thing because that makes life easy.
Well, much easier.
if it was easy, everybody would be millionaires.
Now, RSI is moving above, and it's the best it's been in the, you know, and the two things they talk about, PE and RSI, both of those are in a vacuum, by the way. Both of those stand on their own and doesn't tell you anything about anything relative to anything else. It's just about that stock. And it's kind of funny that they don't use PEG and something else, let's say. All right, let's talk about something else and kind of close on this. When you look at all the indicators today, the breadth, the sentiment, cycles, issues with liquidity, we talked about smooth and choppiness, demographics, seasonality. What is the, if you could culminate all that together, What is that? What message is being sent right now?
Well, one of the messages is that the Fed's thumb is still on the scale.
Yeah.
We are in QE5 right now. We are in the fifth round of doing QE. They started this back in 2009 and it worked great until they stopped it. And then it worked horribly. And then they started it again. And every time they run into trouble, they go back to the QE. Kevin Warsh, the new Fed chairman, has said he does not like the Fed having such a large balance sheet like it has now. But he hasn't said what he's going to do about that. Right now, they're still doing QE at a rate of about $30 billion a month. That's $30 billion is a lot of money. It's not $1 trillion a month like they were doing during COVID back in 2020. In fact, you know, one of the phrases I hate people talk about, the easy money has been made. There's only been one time in my 31 years of doing this newsletter that there was easy money. And that was in 2020 when the Fed announced it was doing $1 trillion in QE. I went leveraged long the NASDAQ.
Yep.
That was easy. When the Fed is throwing that much money at the problem, close your eyes and buy whatever you can and borrow money against everything to buy. And it was a great year.
Yep.
They're not doing $1 trillion a month. They're doing $30 billion a month. That's still pushing the balance sheet up. It's still pushing liquidity into the market.
Yep.
It's smoothing over a lot of the flaws that the market might otherwise have. It's smoothing over a lot of the cycles. When the Fed announces that it's going to stop that, that's a problem. If the Fed announces it's going to go to quantitative tightening, that's a problem for the stock market.
They're not going to call it quantitative tightening, first of all, because they won't say that, right? They'll say
balance sheet readjustment or
yeah.
some.
Yeah, we're just buzzword. Going through a readjustment cycle right now, and just something that we put off for a while that we need to do. They'll figure out a way because they don't want to disrupt the markets. That's the problem. The Fed has become so involved in the markets, whatever that means, and they have to. Tom, honestly, they have so much debt outstanding that any misstep, like what happened in 2022, by the way, where they had to come in and they had to go to the banks and they had to tell the banks, we will guarantee, we will buy the bonds on your books for the maturity, the terminal value of it. Don't worry, we're going to guarantee that. I mean, that's unbelievable. And that is where they're worried about happening, not to the degree from a negative interest rates to a positive interest rates, because that experiment failed miserably. And you can see what happened in Japan recently. The debt factors of what we have now on that, whereas people were paying us to hold debt, now we have to pay them for the same debt. I mean, they're not going to let that mistake happen again. But I guess
they'll find new and innovative ways to screw things up in a different way than the last mistake.
I love it. Tom McClellan, appreciate you coming aboard, being on the show, and good luck with the new puppy and all Thank the things you you're much. Doing. Keep up the great work with and say hi to your dad for me.
I will do that.
All right. Thanks so much. That's going to wrap it for this episode. I want to make sure we're clear on what we talked about at the beginning and make sure that sticks really well. I want that implanted right in the frontal part of your brain, your mind, and when you're thinking. It's all about the fees and the structure. And really, are you making sure that that component of your portfolio is set well? Because if it's not, it's going to be an invisible abrasive inside of your portfolio that's going to be chipping away at returns every single year. Every single 5 years, 10 years, decades, moving into the future. And you know, you're just going to be paying what you shouldn't be paying. That's why we, again, spend an extraordinary amount of time and an incredible amount of time looking at the fee structures of the investments inside your portfolio to look at the net returns, not only after risk, but after the fees as well. Because, you know, you're not going to get around it. There are expenses when it comes to investing. That's good. That's fine. There's no problem. You're going to cut your hair. You're going to pay the barber. You're going to go out to a restaurant. You're going to pay the owner. You're going to buy a car. You're going to pay the manufacturer. It's what it is. It's the cost of doing things. But you know what? Nobody said you have to pay too much. Don't be that sucker. If you need help, we're here for that. Make sure to listen each and every week. Next week coming up is Brian Shannon, the great Brian Shannon, who says and is known as Only Price Pays. Technical analysis at its best. Thanks for joining me this week. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz.